CataractCoach.com podcast series episode number 152 with Dr. Eduardo Alfonso, leading the number one eye institute, the whole eye transplant, and new AI projects. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I've got a very special guest. I've got Dr. Eduardo Alfonso, the chairman of the Bascom Palmer Eye Institute in Miami, which is consistently, for more than 20 years, ranked as the best hospital, the best eye program, the best residency, an amazing place, and we want to know what's the secret sauce.
Well, thank you, Dave, and thank you so much for having me. This is a really fun thing to do for me. I love talking to really smart people like you, and more importantly, to hear from your audience questions that they may have similar to what you just asked. And so thank you so much for all you do and all your audience for all they do. And the secret sauce, is that everything we do has just one goal in mind, our patients. So we do everything we do thinking of we are the patient and what would the patient need and what would be the right thing to do for the patient. If you put that as your North Star in everything you do, then you can develop culture and strategy around that. But without that, you don't go anywhere. So I have a saying that right here in front of me, under the screen, I have a little saying that says, patients come first. And that is something that we have to remind ourselves all the time, whether you're in a academic meeting, administrative meeting, or in the battle in front of a patient. You always have to remind yourself that the patient, whatever you're doing, the patient's well-being comes first.
For sure. So treating from the heart, basically. Obviously treat from the mind, but also from the heart. If this was my family member, what do I want?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've always say that we are fortunate that we have a profession and a vocation, and the two of them come together. So professionally, we are trained to be physicians, but our vocation is to help others. And the two of them come together so nicely in our daily life that that we have to pinch ourselves and say, how lucky can we be? You know, we're doing a lot of stuff that is amazing. To be so fortunate to be given that opportunity by our colleagues, by our patients, and everyone else, our brethren, to do this, is just an incredible opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. You also have talked about in the past about servant leadership, a phrase that sounds a little odd, but if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, you know, it's a good way to always think of why are you doing what you're doing, and there are really very clear examples that we can go back and read about and learn about. And if you look at leadership around the history, every successful leader, at least successful in the sense that they've been able to achieve a culture of excellence, is a servant leader. I've got some good books on that that I've read in the past, and as I read them, there's a lot of commonality in the behavior pattern of servant leadership, and I think that's something that that's what we're here in this world for. We're here to serve others.
Yeah, beyond the obvious meaning, what's the deeper meaning in servant leadership?
I think that the important thing is always thinking of how you can help others achieve their goals. And to me, removing obstacles is number one. Always looking for opportunities, and as I've always said, there's never a problem. A problem is always an opportunity to do something better. So don't look at it as we have a problem. No, we have an opportunity to do something better. So that servant leadership role, I don't think about it all the time, but I try to emulate the idea that I need to be here to remove obstacles from other people's path and to help others achieve the best that they can achieve. And in that process, we we have to fight our own natural tendencies of egotism, narcissism. You know, these are things that are embedded in humanity. And and whether we say, well, I'm not narcissistic. Yes, I am narcissistic. We all are. And we just have to make sure that that narcissism doesn't become malignant narcissism and that we control it. We are all egotistical. Our egos want to feed on themselves all the time. And yes, are we egotistical? Yes, we all are. But we have to make sure we understand how we can modulate that. And so it's a constant, process of existence. And I think that helps others, achieve the best they can achieve. And if I were to think of the Bascom-Palmer Institute, what's the core reason why the Bascom-Palmer has been able to do some of the things that our colleagues call us out for, which are things that we don't necessarily think about doing, but we do them, is that our faculty, our staff, and every human being that is within the walls and outside the walls of the Bascom-Palmer Institute are trying their best to help another human being. And doing that is just what drives that special sauce of the Bascom-Palmer Institute. And in a parenthesis, I want to say, is when someone like you comes to the Bascom-Palmer Institute as a visiting professor, which you have, and sure, you instill that those same ideas and that you extol, because we wouldn't have you come here if we didn't think that you had the right role models for everyone here to be exposed to. That just continues to feed on this process.
Right. Now, you've assembled an incredible team under your chairmanship of almost 20 years now. You really have incredible faculty members. What do you look for in a faculty member? Like, do you see something on a CV that leads you this way? Or is it more of a personal interaction and getting to know their philosophy?
I always figure that by the time they're applying for a position here, that I don't have to look at their CV. I don't. And I really, I don't. I remember once when I was at Mass Ioneer, that someone said, well, how good you are depends on the weight of your CV. And so when I held your CV and said, if it's heavy, that means you're a good. And I said, no, so I don't even look at CVs. What I look for is a positive attitude.
Right.
And if that person has a positive attitude towards life, towards even difficult times in their lives that they may want to talk about, that positive attitude permeates to everyone else and to themselves. Coming to work every day with a smile and coming to work with a positive attitude of what are we going to do today, which is good, is extremely important to me. And if someone, just can't put that together, it's not a great idea. And it's not that we have to drink the Kool-Aid, that we're going to be happy all the time. No, there are a lot of times that things are not right. And we are not happy with that. But we have to take that unhappiness and repackage it into a positive attitude.
For sure. In fact, that's probably where you get these amazing ideas, like the whole eye transplant, the moonshot. Mm-hmm. I've had patients print this out from online and bring it to me to ask me about this. Tell me more about the moonshot whole eye transplant project.
Well, I made sure that we put the adjective there of moonshot, right, because this is no different than our other kind of great crazy ideas that humanity has had in the past. And of course, transplanting an eye is not a new idea. It's been around for eons of years. But what I wanted to do was really, at this point, the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute had a stage presence that could bring in the idea that we can collate scientific ideas and work towards the concept that, yes, one day we may be able to transplant an eye. Again, not my idea. I remember 15 years ago, I was at the National Eye Institute, and we had a workshop on audacious ideas. And one of the audacious ideas was an eye transplant. Prior to that, I remember, 30 years ago, being at the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute and listening to, different scientists talk about the concept of potentially looking towards an eye transplant. I think that that moonshot concept is that we are developing a lot of science around this idea of a whole eye transplant that will spin off into amazing things. For example, who would have thought that someone would spend time producing an ECMO device, an extracorporeal membrane oxygenation device for the eye?
Right.
And we've just done that. So through that ARPA funding for the whole eye transplant, which was one of the ideas, let's get this going because we can get philanthropy to support eye science. We can get the federal funding to support eye science. So it was getting an excitement around a concept that only ophthalmology can harness,
right?
Because strategically, I can talk to you about stem cells. I can talk to you about gene therapy. I can talk to you about personalized medicine, but that's the whole of medicine. That doesn't pertain to what we do in ophthalmology. By talking about an eye transplant, what are we doing? We are gathering attention to what we do in ophthalmology. We're not with the big group. We're in our own group here. And so the eye transplant concept really brings it home to what do we do in vision science and ophthalmology. And so it's really, brought your patients to you to ask you about this incredible potential of doing an eye transplant.
Right. Now, interesting, you brought up the ECMO. That's obviously very important. So when you have a donor eye, as soon as you sever the blood supply to it, the retina nerve tissues will start to die off. You've got to have replacement for that immediately.
Right. So we have an ECMO device. You can see it on our webpage. And our team has been able to go to the transplant center here at the University of Miami and take from a living donor who's going to pass away, has been able to take that eye out and connect it to the ECMO device and continue the circulation of the nutrients that the eye needs to stay alive. And just think of now what we can do with that, even in the laboratory, keeping a in vivo eye to be able to do research on, to transform that eye in the ECMO device to a super eye, having you take out the cataract and put in an IOL, transplant a retinal chip into it, try to put some stem cells into the optic nerve to help it grow perhaps even a healthier transplanted optic nerve. So we can do a lot of things in this ECMO device to that eye that will be amazing scientific, that will lead to amazing scientific discoveries.
Yeah, just the ECMO device alone is a game changer. I recently did cataract surgery on dozens of cadaver eyes in preparation for doing the world's first robotic cataract surgery, which we did a couple months ago in October of last year. And cadaver eyes, you'd think would be very good, but even a 24-year-old cadaver eye is not the same as a regular living eye.
Right.
They're very different.
Right. Yep. So with this concept of developing a mechanical device that can keep an eye alive from a donated situation, I think it's already spinning off an enormous amount of scientific ideas of how to work. So I'm sure that, 3-5 years from now at ARVO, we're going to be sitting there and everyone is going to be talking about the projects they did on an ECMO eye, right?
Right, because now you can do like experiments on a new macular drug or new macular procedure or surgery on actually a living eye.
Right.
You obviously can't check acuity afterwards, but you can at least see how the tissue responds.
Yeah, right. So this is why it's called a moonshot project, because a lot of these ideas are spinning off. And I'm just giving you an example of one. I mean, if you listened yesterday to our research conference given by Dr. Sanjoy Bhattacharya, he's talking about optic nerve regeneration. I mean, right. it's amazing the type of stuff that now these basic scientists can do on this tissue.
For sure. Yeah, you've always been like cutting edge. I still remember hearing about use of ChatGPT in your grand rounds of Bascom. Like you integrated it, I didn't know it. Tell me more about this, because this is obviously a very hot topic, the AI.
Well, yeah, you know, back when we first had the large language models of looking at using them in a computerized way, we had the ability to do some learning models for ophthalmology, and so we did experiment a little bit with this in our didactic educational modules, and one of them was Grand Rounds, and of course everyone was watching it, so it made a big impact. So this is about 3-4 years ago, 4 years ago I think it was now, but we've been using machine learning and large language models for different things for a while, and I can't say we were pioneers in it, but we developed the interest in taking technology that is translatable to patient care and figuring out how to do that. So, for example, in my particular area of interest, fungal keratitis, we started using computer learning models to figure out how to better diagnose fungal keratitis. And we started that now, I would say 25 years ago. And certainly the computing ability has improved significantly. And now that we can share that computing ability in a democratized way, I think it's terrific. You know, it used to be that you had to know someone who had the big computer to be able to do this, right?
Now
it's been so democratized, that is wonderful. People are really doing amazing things with the technology.
How else are you using AI in the clinics?
So we're trying to see where it is most applicable. And as you know, for example, in our EPIC electronic health record, specifically Kaleidoscope, which is the ophthalmology version of it, we've embedded through a program with Microsoft Copilot, which is the Microsoft version of AI in a large language model. So it helps us look for things. So, you know, I could be seeing a patient who has been seen in multiple places, and I'm like sitting here thinking, how am I going to search through all these electronic health records that are available for me to look for something? And I can ask Copilot to do that for me. And it does it in a very short period of time. We can also use agents that we teach to do certain things. For example, if I'm going to do cataract surgery on you, and I want to know if you've been on medication X, and most of our patients say, well, doctor, I can't even remember what medications I took yesterday, right? But it may be in that electronic health record. There's ways to teach agents to prompt you to the fact that some of these things that you want to know about the patient come forward to you right away. So in searching through that is terrific. And then we've used it for some predictive analytics. We started working with a group with the Microsoft Azure Cloud to, for example, predict the incidence of myopia in certain populations around the world. And one of our partnering institutions, the L.V. Prasad Eye Institute in Hyderabad, this was done in Hyderabad, and Nag Rao and team were able to figure out where were the pockets of significant myopia, so you can deploy resources.
Mm.
To those areas and not and not be guessing of, you know, in retrospect, well, we are seeing so many patients with this, now we need that. How can we do predictive analytics to predict what's going to happen and be ready for it? So those were just some of the things we're doing, but our, you know, our research team led by Felipe Medeiros, who's a big data scientist, and Yusefi Siamek, who is a AI expert and has two R01 grants that have been, he's held for many years, and they've all been related to artificial intelligence. These folks are just doing things that I can't not even explain to you.
Well, it's always great to have a brilliant team there.
Yeah. I sit to some of these research conferences and I say, can I just have an AI pill that I can take to understand what just happened here in this conference? Because I missed out.
Right. Another exciting thing is, you know, we're anticipated to have a shortage of ophthalmologists in the coming years. And the ability to do digital or AI-based digital exams or even remote patient monitoring is another topic.
Awesome. It's an awesome area. You know, patient access. If I feel guilty about something, that if I tell you, I think you're going to say, yeah, Eddie, I feel guilty about that, is that we have grown and somewhat supported a very broken healthcare system, right? And we all know that, you know, access to care and preventive care have not kept up with where we want it to be. And our ability to have key performance indicators for what we do, quality, outcomes, and safety measures, we have not been able to really put them into use as fast as we would like to. I know that the, you know, Verana Health and the IRIS Registry is trying to help us get to that, but the idea that we can improve patient access and patient access to high quality care, right? We want to have those two components together. It's something that that is very exciting, that technology is giving us a quantum leap access to being able to do that. You know, we were growing in medicine, as I always say, like the Flintstones, in a very linear way. Mm-hmm. But I think that with technology today, we are able to grow and develop what we're doing in a very logarithmic way that leads to some of these technologies that you mentioned, the remote patient monitoring devices, the diagnostic devices that don't necessarily need to have the presence of a eye care provider in front of the patient, can be done remotely. And the data accessed in a very careful way. So I think the technology is just exciting. And all I need to do is be like Abraham and live to be 140 years old, because it's so exciting. What's happening is amazing.
In the future, we'll have the special iPhone eye exam. You look in your phone, it'll scan your eyes. It'll send all the data. It'll AI analyze. It'll say, "Oh, you need to see the ophthalmologist."
Yeah, it may be even further than that. That with some of the robotic technologies that you're working on, right, the idea is that, you know, some of the devices that we're going to be able to equip the patients with will be able to do many of the things that we manually have to do today with the patient in front of us, right? I see the day when we may be able to send a robotic device to where the patient is and do some of the things that that we today have to rely on a human being doing. You know, we know that, I mean, you've been exposed to the field a lot more than anyone else, but when you visit some of the institutes that are developing robotics, you begin to see what amazing discoveries they're making every day to make robots really help humans be better humans.
For sure. I mean, it's pretty straightforward to even now have a robot to do all your intravitreal injections. Right. That could certainly be developed with an incredible degree of accuracy because needle placement even will be OCT guided.
Right. And with, like I said, with better quality, outcomes and safety. And that's why we always have to stress that we need better ways to really continue to look at ourselves in a prospective way of making sure that what we're doing has the right key performance indicators embedded into it.
Right. One of the tough parts, though, is kind of when we go so digital, so computerized, so automated, so robotic, is just kind of keeping the human touch in it, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you know, I don't fear that as much as, you know, some people try to make it into a big deal that, well, you know, are we giving up our humanity? I don't think we will ever give up our humanity. I think that we will improve our humanity. And if we look at the history of humankind, every technological advance has made us be more aware of how we can be better humans. And so I think that that will continue to be the case. Some people say, well, you know, how will a robotic device or provide empathy? Yeah, maybe empathy is one of these things that our neocortex does that we may not be able to develop a way to emulate it just like our neocortex does. But we may be able to get closer to it, and empathy may be viewed upon in a different way than what we view it today. So time is never neutral. Time is always changing. So the fact that we need to just embrace what we're doing today and just make it better. And again, continue to measure ourselves against what we think are the right standards of measurement to make sure that what we're doing is good for others.
For sure. I think that's a great point. Now, you mentioned earlier about your interest in fungal keratitis. About 20 years ago, you really put yourself on the map when you figured out the whole issue with the contact lens fusarium fungal infections. Tell us more about that time, because from the outside, it was like, wow, how did you figure that out?
Well, the lack of I would say methods to processes to figure that out led to human interaction figuring it out. The anecdote is great. You know, we were at the World Congress in Brazil, and a couple of colleagues were next to me, and we were talking about, you know, fungal keratitis, and someone said, and I can't remember who it was, says, you know, we've seen a little uptick in fungal keratitis. And what's interesting is that some of these patients are wearing soft contact lenses. Mm-hmm. And the other person, yeah, I think we've seen it too. And I said, yeah, we've seen it too. So called our lab here in Miami, our microbiologist, and said, you know, could you pull for me data from the last 3 months to see if we're seeing an uptick in fungal keratitis and contact lens wearers? And of course, you know, I wouldn't know because our patients come in through the emergency room, the cornea clinic, the residence clinic. So I would have not seen all these patients, so it would have been hard. But our microbiologist quickly, within 24 hours, pulled out from the microbiology logbooks and looked at these patients and says, yeah, Dr. Alfonso, we really have a significant increase in patients with contact lens-related keratitis. At that point, one of our colleagues in New Jersey had already written a letter to the CDC warning that he was aware that this was happening. I called the CDC. CDC was a little slow to react. I called the FDA. They were a little slow to react. And my colleagues that were maybe a group of 5 to 6 of us that were just on the phone all the time talking about this said, the only way we can stop this from continuing is if we go out to the press. Because the CDC is not doing it fast enough. The FDA is not doing it fast enough. I called the AJO to have a expedited publication of a paper, but that would have taken a month. And we were seeing these patients losing vision. So we really needed to get the message out that if you wear a contact lens, please stop wearing those contact lenses right away, because we don't know why there's a higher incidence of this horrible infection in patients like you. So hopefully that stopped the epidemic that we were seeing. And we had all sorts of wild theories at that time. We said, well, maybe, you know, the fires in the West, maybe the Sahara Desert sandstorms, and is doing it. Maybe we just went through hurricanes, and we're coming with all these cockamamie theories, but really we had no way to prove it until we started doing some more digging, and then it became obvious that there was a particular product involved that may have been introduced without certain knowledge that the product could degrade in a way that would allow it to have fungi grow but bacteria is killed. And so we were able to at least stop that from happening, but then we realized that there were still other ways that that fungi had evolved into an organism that was a lot more pathogenic than it had been before. And as I do in all my lectures, my last slide in every lecture is, our next great epidemic will be a fungal epidemic. And that's not my words. Those are the words of scientists that have published a paper in Scientific America some years ago that showed that that continued pressure on organisms like eukaryotes, which are fungi, are going to make them continue to evolve into a different organism. And they have to feed and live. And we humans are a great source of food.
Right. Right. It was so interesting is that, yeah, finally the mystery was solved, and it turned out that it was a contact lens solution, as you're saying. I think, if I recall correctly, it was the Renew with the moisture lock.
Right, yeah, it was that was one. There were a couple of other, it was interesting, because there were a couple of other solutions that came into being. And the real question that, I always ask is, what came first, the chicken or the egg, right? Right. Did these organisms truly evolve to become more resistant to what was in those solutions? And what we saw was not just that particular solution, but we saw it in other contact lens related solutions. And today we still see it, right? That solution is no longer there. And if you listen to one of my lectures that I would have given in 1987, 1988, I would always say that wearing contact lenses was protective against developing fungal keratitis, because we never saw a patient that wore a contact lens and developed fungal keratitis. And my theory at that time was that if you were wearing contact lenses and you got hit by a branch, the branch would first hit the contact lens and protect your cornea from an abrasion. So it was in fact protective. But fast forward to later, to 2005, and now we see that the number one cause of fungal keratitis in urban environments is wearing contact lenses.
Right. And if some of the contact lens solutions are very effective against bacteria but do nothing against the fungus, well, now the fungus can grow unopposed, and right, you've upset the whole flora.
Another protozoans like amoebas, right? And even today, we just recently put together a paper I think there were over 8 or 10 different new fungi that have never been described as human pathogens. These are fungi that occur in the wild in our environment. And have been living happily in vegetation, et cetera. And we're beginning to see that pressure on those environments is causing these fungi to now become pathogens to humans. Right. And we're, that's that interplay that we all have as part of our of nature.
You mentioned also that how your thoughts and have changed from, let's say, the late 80s to the 2000s to even now. So there's an evolution of thought. But you've also had a great evolution in like surgical technique and skill within your field, let's say, of cornea anterior segment.
Yeah, it's been amazing. I mean, the use of new technologies have afforded us the ability to think, how can we best use these technologies to help a patient? And the fortunate thing we've had in our field of anterior segment surgery, cornea cataract surgery, is that the amount of technology that has evolved to make everything we do less stressful on our coronaries is wonderful. You know, and if you think about it, I would always say here at the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute, when people would say, well, you know, do we really need the femtosecond to improve the outcome of cataract surgery? And I would say, it may not improve the outcome to the patient, but it will certainly improve the ability of that surgeon not to have coronary stress.
Right. Right, for sure.
And so there are a lot of things that have developed that I think are great for our field. And in terms of just some of the things that we've done in the area of cornea, I remember, you know, and this is a story that Jeff Goldberg says when he was a second year resident here. Jeff Goldberg today is the chair at Stanford. When he was a second year resident, he was sitting next to me. I was doing a corneal transplant. He was watching. Course, he was asking all sorts of great questions, and I said, you know, Jeff, I think that one day we're really going to have to take this very awful procedure of a cookie cutter being put on top of the eye and taking off a cornea and doing this way, and really figure out how to really do what we need to do, which is to replace the endothelial cells, which is the damage that this patient has. Jeff took that idea and has been working on it since then, and certainly has now taken it to clinical trials where he is injecting endothelial cells into human eyes and replacing human endothelium. So how did that happen? A lot of technology, a lot of science. I mean, this, it wasn't just like that. I give all the credit to Jeff. My idea, as we say, ideas are easy to come by. It's the work that leads the idea to become a reality that really should get all the credit. And all the credit goes to Jeff Goldberg for taking an idea and just moving it along the path of discovery.
For sure. I mean, just the process of going from full thickness penetrating keratoplasty to then maybe decades later DSEC and then DMEC, and now just put the cells directly. Amazing.
And I think, you know, the next step is going to be how to just change these cells, you know, look at why they're cells that don't work well after a certain period of time and continue to work on that concept. And I'm sure we're going to develop technologies that will allow us to do that. The ECMO device may be one of those. You know, let's say we work on eyes that already have Fuchs dystrophy and we figure out how to continue to work with them in an ex vivo environment like the ECMO device that we talked earlier and figure out what needs to change in these cells.
Right. Yeah, I think that ECMO device is going to be an absolute game changer for all kinds of advances across all of ophthalmology, just because you can now do these trials in your lab.
Right. Yeah, it's a way of having your in vivo situation, but in an ex vivo environment. Yeah.
You've had a lot, like Jeff, you've had a lot of amazing residents who then obviously go on to have huge, impressive careers in ophthalmology. But there's something special about your residency. There is a special sauce. And why do you think that so many of your residents do such amazing things?
You know, number one, you know, since I came to Bascom-Palmer, and I remember when I applied to residencies back in 1978, that's how old I am. And at that time, we were just starting to match. So some residencies were offering you a position right away. Other ones were offering you a position through the match. I remember that Bascom-Palmer was not in the radar screen for me. I was at that time a medical student at Yale. And certainly the programs that were in my radar screen were all the Northeast programs and the West Coast programs, UCLA, UCSF, which were the two main West Coast programs. And so Bascom-Palmer was not in the radar screen for me, but there were two individuals that called me up and said, hey, can you consider this? And these were people that I met along the interview process. One was Vinny DeLuise, who was in Connecticut, but he was a resident here, and Vinny had been a resident. Bobby Osher and Stanley Chang. And these three individuals had just gone through training at Bascom-Palmer and really propped it up much more than I had ever heard about when I was a medical student at Yale. And I told my wife, hey, I'm going to go to Miami because I've arranged to get an interview there. I'm not sure that that's the program I'm going to end up at because Miami was not in our radar screen. But when I came here, I saw an incredible culture of this excitement to do things that just, I don't know, I had a gut feeling that this was a good place to come to. And it was a leap of faith at that time compared to, you know, some of the other more name branded programs in the Northeast that I could have ended up doing my residency at, or in the West Coast. And so I took that leap of faith. That continues to be the culture for the residents here at the Bascom-Palmer Institute. That same experience I had back in 1978 when I first looked at this program, hardworking clinical program, attracts individuals that really espouse the team effort. Together, everyone achieves more. I love that acronym. And everyone, you know, kind of works together. And, you know, where's the chairman's office? You walk out that door and you're in the emergency room of the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute. And it is staffed by residents. The residence clinic is right across the hallway from me. So the most important component of what we do here at the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute is the thought that we are giving that next generation of ophthalmology an opportunity to learn. And as I tell everyone that I report up to, from the president of the University of Miami, the board of trustees, the dean, etc., that we are here because we believe that our mission is to train the next generation of people that will take the role of what of some of the things we're doing. And the moment we don't do that, then there's really no need to really have even the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute. We can be, you know, private practice group, working without residents and fellows, which, as I tell everyone, you know, residents and fellows do cost us a lot of money. People think, well, you know, you make money by having residents and fellows do your clinical work. And I clearly don't think that that's the case.
No, I can agree with you there for sure. it's certainly, yeah, you have to be passionate about teaching residents. And I think you certainly are. Everyone at Bascom is as well. It's a really resident and fellow focused place. It's really about the learning. And I think they feel that. But the residents, to their credit also, they work very hard.
Yeah. No, they do. And they realize that they have to help our community, which is thriving and growing and have a lot of vision care. And they're very socially conscious group of people. I mean, they really put a lot of effort in trying to help patients that would otherwise not have the access to care that they have because of the fact that they're coming here. So I think it's a wonderful mission. And in that respect, you know, it starts feeding on itself because people realize what's the culture of the residency here. And if they think they fit in that culture, then they're likely to choose to come here. And if not, you know, as I tell the resident applicants, you know, we're so fortunate in the United States, and that if you look at all of our residency programs, they're superb. They are superb, and there's no reason why a resident applicant should ever feel that they're a second-class citizen because they went to Program X. Every program in the AUPO, and especially the residency review committees and the fellowship review committees hosted by the AUPO, the Association of University Professors of Ophthalmology, make sure that those that we're training are getting the best training that needs to happen.
Right. For sure. I think that is true as well. Yes, you have an amazing residency program. I think you fit in so well because you are a Bascom-Palmer product back in your residency training. But ultimately, at the end of the day, wherever you are training, whether it's anywhere in the U.S. or abroad, you know, the cook is probably more important than the kitchen. A good cook can cook in any kitchen. So if you have the talent and the drive and the motivation, you can be a great ophthalmologist no matter where you train.
Amen. I 100% feel that way. And the quest for learning never stops. And so I think that that one of the things that is beautiful in our profession is that we continue to learn with through whatever means we have. I, as an example to our faculty, I have a a lifetime certificate from the American Board of Ophthalmology. I have recertified voluntarily every cycle since recertification started. Why is it important? Because it's learning. And I don't want to stop learning. And people are going to say, yeah, but it's a waste of time because that really doesn't give you the most efficient way of learning. Heck, tell me what's the most efficient way of learning in you or you or you. We all have different efficiencies that we use. Yeah. And to me, to be able to, you know, to every quarter to answer the questions that are posed to me by the American Board of Ophthalmology so that I can recertify in my next cycle, which is 2035. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, we all certainly learn differently. And I think you see that now among the young generations. You know, obviously, a cataract coach is very, very popular among ophthalmologists, let's say in their 30s and 40s, very popular, because they tend to learn by these short form videos. And that's why we've made a new video every day for 2,800 days in a row.
Right.
And, but even more surprising, though, is even the generation younger than them, current medical students now, I've been amazed, they get their materials, their learning materials, they put it into an AI, you know, large language model, and ask the model to now quiz them.
Yep.
It's amazing.
Right. No, it's great. I mean, I think harnessing and using technology is something that we have to encourage people to do. And, you know, and I've heard colleagues in the industry say this, so I'm quoting them, that, you know, we as humans, and in particularly ophthalmologists, need to embrace technology and use it, because if we don't, then we will be humans that will not be supporting humanity in the way that humans that do use technology do. And and I think that that's extremely important. And I, you know, I know we're running out of time, but if I can put in a plug in for wellness, and I know that sometimes we get embedded in doing something all the time and we forget that we still, as humans, need to think about, you know, the work we do intellectually, the work we do physically, but we have a spiritual side of us that is extremely important to nurture, and it doesn't have to be a religious spirituality, but we all have in our brains, that part of our brains that is nurtured by spiritual activities, whatever they may be, and that we need to take care of ourselves, exercise well, take care of your nutrition, and have the ability to do things that that are well-rounded in your daily existence.
Oh, that's such great advice. And I'm guilty of not doing that so well sometimes.
We are all. We all are, and we just have to remind ourselves to do it, right? Because we say, oh, gee, you know, New Year's resolution, I'm going to do a little bit more of that. Do it.
Right. Right. Well, what great advice. Eddie, I want to thank you so much for spending the last almost hour chit-chatting with me and teaching us all about your incredible projects in ophthalmology and how the Bascom-Palmer Eye Institute has done such amazing things. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, and continue to do what you do. You're doing fantastic work for all of us.
I appreciate it.
We're the beneficiaries of what you do.
Thank you so much. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Category Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Anywhere you find a podcast, you find the Category Coach podcast. And of course, we got a new Category Coach video every single day. Plus, now we even have our sister channel, RetinaRounds.com. Check that out as well.